Listening to sermons as we go about our days, driving around or doing our work, is a perfect reminder of our Lord's promises and of His mercies. This is the mission of Upper Room Media: to make the Word of God accessible to anybody and everybody.
So the series that we began, I want to say it's been a while now, it's been over a month or two now that we've been really like diving into the passions. Now we're going to talk about a big one that plagues our society, because we live in a secular world where everything is overly sexualized and everyone is encouraged to be extremely promiscuous, not to mention the fact that we're encouraged to be able to indulge in the desires that we have of the flesh. And so because of this, I feel like you're so far away, Bessem. And I feel like I miss you. Do you want to bring Bessem next to us? Notice how I did that mid-sentence, because I saw your beautiful face. So today we want to talk specifically about fornication. Okay, so let's begin a little bit about the understanding of what the church means when it talks about fornication. There is a rumor that goes around today specifically, and very unfortunately, in a lot of Christian circles, that basically says that the gospel never actually spoke up against so many of the different sexual movements that exist today under the banner of the LGBTQ movement, right? And so they say the church only ever spoke about, you know, adultery. Adultery here being this idea of a man stepping out on his wife. Where in reality, what they fail to do is to recognize the language of the time. When the church spoke of fornication or lust, it used a word called pornea. Notice how pornea is exactly where we also get the word pornography, right? Pornea is everything, every action that has to do with a sexual choice, a sexual behavior that is outside of God's design. Now, for some reason, there are people who believe that this is only in the idea of sex outside of marriage, but there's a lot more under that banner. Because when they spoke of pornea in the Old Testament, as well as in the New Testament, the church has always understood it to be every action that goes against anything that God designed. What was it that God designed? That one man should have one woman, and the man shall leave his father and mother, and shall be joined to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh. This is God's design. Man and woman, in marriage, a covenantal relationship of commitment, where they leave everything behind, and the two become one. There is a commitment, there is a covenant that happens between a man and a woman within marriage. Any sexual act that is performed outside of that design becomes pornea. This is why prostitution falls under pornea. Because a man or a woman is willing to pay someone who is not committed to them in order for them to be able to indulge in their desires. Homosexuality falls under pornea because it is a reflection of how it is that God's design of man and woman is being fought against. Transgenderism will even fall under this, because to be transgender is not only to identify as something or as someone other than who you are, but also to act on that sexually. All of these things will fall under the idea of pornea. So when we speak of pornea today, I don't want you to only imagine it as something that is only reflected as adultery, or something that is reflected only as extramarital sex. We really are talking about of every single deviation of God's plan. Obviously, under this also falls the addiction to pornography, an addiction to masturbation, and every other sexual act where we're only feeding the desires without the covenantal, committed relationship that can exist between a man and a woman under God's design. Do you see it? It's important that we have that definition before we begin, so you can understand what we mean when we speak about fornication and lust. Okay? I also think it's important for us, when we're having this conversation, to understand that when we speak of sexuality, there are some people who believe it to be something that is very taboo. So we can see. Let me share something with you that Jean-Claude Larchet says, and I think he says it beautifully. He says, the use of sexuality in the context of marriage is not at all to be condemned, for it permits the perpetuation of the human race in the new state in which it finds itself, and for this reason is blessed by God. There's absolutely nothing wrong with sexuality. There's absolutely nothing wrong with sexual intimacy. For some reason, there are people who speak of it. Now, listen, there is a debate in the church as to whether or not sex was introduced only after the fall. There is that conversation among some of the fathers of the church, where they believe that in the original design by God, before they fell into sin, They did not have to reproduce using that kind of, if you wish, animalistic approach. This was something that was blessed by God in consequence to the fall. Now, regardless of that is true or not, there is something to be said about how it is that this is perfectly designed by God. We were having a sex ed day with some of our younger kids, grade four and five. This was like several weeks ago. And it was really cute to see these kids sit there in church and they're staring at the screen and the servants are like giving them like anatomy class, right? So they're sitting there and they're talking about the human reproductive systems, and there's these little girls, Habibi, who are in grade five, and they're staring at the screen and they want to die. They want to die because there's a picture of like this guy who's on the screen, and obviously it's just a drawing. It's like, you know those anatomy charts, right? But she's sitting there and she's staring at the male reproductive system, and the little girl who's in fourth grade or fifth grade, she wants to melt into her seat because she doesn't know how to react. And unfortunately, I feel like some Egyptians, even at the age of 40 or 45, still feel the same way, right? Where you talk about human sexuality and people begin to melt away as if it was something that's taboo, something that we shouldn't look at as holy and beautiful. And this is foolishness. Do you think that this intricate design by which a man and a woman can come together and express their love for one another, and that God uses this very mechanism, this intimacy, this coming together in union as a means to reproduce, you think all of this is haphazard? Do you think, possibly, that even the orgasm that God has allowed the human being to experience in its fullness, do you think that that's accidental? We shouldn't think that way. Sex is holy. And the act of intimacy between a man and a woman who are in a covenantal, committed relationship with one another as husband and wife is something that is perfectly designed by God. It is in that understanding that you will then begin to realize that any desecration of that holy and blessed design is sinful. Anything that pursues that without the commitment, without the covenant, without the union, without the blessing of God, that's where it becomes absolutely destructive. And I think this is where we have to truly, truly be careful. The reason it is sinful is because it disgraces God's design. So in the context of marriage, the passion of lust does not consist then in making use of the sexual function, but it's to preserve and abuse it. You see, marriage was one of the means by which the church told her children, get married so you can fight lust. Lust that desires only to take. Fornication that desires only to think of itself selfishly. But now you are in a covenantal and committed relationship where you can now learn to give. Use marriage as a means to be able to defeat that passion. But instead, what happens? A person who is still lusting even within their marriage, all they want to do is abuse the other person across from them. My wife or my husband are nothing more than a tool that I use, that I objectify, for the single use of only being able to scratch my itch whenever I get it, right? And this, I think, is part of the biggest problem that we have even until today in so many relationships that exist even after marriage, where people think that somehow I can act lustfully and I can live a life that is filled with a whole different expressions of fornication. And then when I get married, oh, well, it's fine, right? Because once I get married, I have carte blanche. I can then have sex and it's not sinful, so I can give up this other stuff. But I think this is where we're very foolish. Lust by nature is a passion that forces you to take the pleasure that is found physically in the desires of wanting to be sexually intimate and keeping them solely for yourself, and you objectify them to the point where they become an idol. So let me explain to you why it is that the church speaks in this way. Lust becomes one of those things where if you're not careful, your expressions of that kind of fornication, instead of you seeing God's design as an opportunity for you to offer yourself, all you want to do is take. When all you want to do is take, all you're concerned with is satisfying the needs of your desires, your fantasies. When you are constantly only thinking of your fantasies and your desires, you're only focused on pleasing who? Yourself. When you are the center of all that you want to satisfy, then there can be no giving of the self. There can be no offering. There can be no selflessness. There's no self-emptying. All you are doing is taking, taking, taking. There was this really interesting experiment a huge analysis that was performed, I think, on over 400 people at the university in the States. I think it was the University of Pennsylvania, but I don't remember where the article came out from. What they basically did is that they put these neuron scanners, transmitter things, they basically put these sticky things on people's heads, okay? And they were capable of identifying different places where when they identify activity in the brain, it lets them know how you categorize things. And they showed them pictures. And so they sat down a whole bunch of like 400 different people, college students, and they would show them pictures. And they would show them a picture of a chair. And, you know, the brain would be triggered in the area where something was a tool, something that was an object to be used. Then they would show them food in a different section. They would show them a picture of a grandmother hugging a child, an older woman hugging a child, and a different area would be triggered to show relationship. Okay? They showed a woman at work, working. And again, a different area of the brain would be triggered. And then they started really getting really interesting by showing pictures of women where those women were being totally objectified. They started showing pictures of women in very scandalous clothing. They started showing pictures of women that were basically almost naked. And then they actually started showing pictures that were full-blown pornographic. Eventually, what they started realizing in doing this exercise is that the brain no longer started to trigger that same area where they saw relationship, that same area where they saw human beings. The same area that was triggering for tables and chairs and hammers and tools was now being triggered whenever they saw pornographic material. You ever understand the idea of objectification? The human being becomes nothing more than an object. This person only has a functional purpose. They are to be used by me. This table is only good if I can use it as a table. This hammer is only good if I can use it as a hammer. This person on the screen is only good if I can use him or her to satisfy my desires. The intention behind the passion of lust is not only that you may indulge in worshiping yourself, to offer to yourself whatever pleases you, but it ultimately destroys the very image of God that you are supposed to recognize in your neighbor. Because this is why Christ is capable of saying in the Gospel of St. Matthew, where he says in Matthew chapter 5, whoever looks at a woman and lusts after her in his heart has already committed adultery. Has already committed adultery. Because you have already gone there. Now what's really interesting, and I think most of us fail to realize this, is that when we speak specifically of lust, we fail to realize that lust doesn't begin in the flesh. Where does fornication and lust begin? Where does fornication and lust begin?
The mind.
100%, the mind. Fornication and lust is first a battle that happens at the level of the mind. Listen to this. Human sexuality is mental before it is physical. The desire which is fulfilled through the body does not come from the body, notes St. Clement of Alexandria. Most often the body is led to sin by a desire born in the heart and developed to the point of entailing the passage into physical action. The problem is when everything begins here. A lot of our young women will struggle when it comes to not necessarily being attracted to lustful things in the same way that our men are. Young men are very attracted through the eyes. The senses of the eyes are something that are very indulgent for our young men specifically. That's not to say that it's not also found in women, but the struggle sometimes is very different. So you'll see that some of our young women, and this begins at a very young age, like I sit with like 13 and 14 year old girls who are already finding themselves in these situations, where they're so enveloped by the idea of the fantasy that is in the mind, the daydreaming of the mind, the reading of romantic novels in order for them to be able to imagine these characters living out this extremely detailed journey together, and then this journey is somehow completely, like, it's under the narrative of something hyper, hyper romantic, and eventually it turns into something steamy and great and wonderful for her to be able to sit there and fantasize about. that is the beginning of this passage of lust that this poor little person is going to go through is going to begin first at the level of the mind. The same way that you will notice, the same way that you're going to notice that when we're having this conversation, specifically about battling lust, we oftentimes talk about how it is that it's triggered by something that you see, or it's triggered by something that, you know, your eyes glanced over, and then unfortunately you can't get rid of the image. But the problem with imagery is that it finally stores itself where? All imagery ends up storing itself in the mind. So let's do this as an example. I want you to close your eyes. Everyone, close your eyes, please. Close your eyes. Everyone. Close your eyes. This shouldn't be too hard. Close your eyes. Okay? Ready? Do not picture a rabbit. What just happened? Open your eyes. As soon as I said, do not picture a rabbit, what popped into your mind?
A rabbit.
Why is that?
An elephant.
An elephant? Yeah, but the wires are not connected properly.
It's a big rabbit.
That's a big rabbit. Why does that happen? The battlefield really begins at the level of the mind, because whether you like it or not, anything and everything that you've ever exposed yourself to is capable of registering itself at the level of the mind. And if you don't stop it at the level of the mind, it descends into the heart. When it descends into the heart, this is where like the real battle now is, like, it's almost won for the evil one. Because at this point, if it has descended into the heart, the action is going to follow very quickly. And the problem that we have, and I still remember this, like, I still remember the first time I ever saw anything pornographic in my life. I still remember exactly where I was and how I looked at a screen that I really should not have been looking at when I went to go to a neighbor's house, and his older brother was there with a whole bunch of his guy friends, and at 8 years old, my eyes saw things that they were never meant to see. I still remember that moment extremely vividly. I remember exactly what was on the screen. Images have a way of being able to imprint themselves in our mind. Now imagine if I'm the kind of person who has surrounded myself with these kind of images and I indulge in them. I go looking for them. I try to cater to them. And now, because of these demonic little devices that we have, you literally have any option and every option that you want. And so what ends up happening is that we customize our fantasies. We feed ourselves whatever we want. And the more you feed the soul these kind of images, the more the mind begins to store them. So when you are not looking at these things and you're fighting for repentance and you're pursuing a life of purity, all the devil has to do is whisper certain thoughts to you, and the images come flooding in. And while you might not be staring in front of a screen looking for it actively, it's very difficult to fight off those images. I remember during the 40 days at the monastery, one of the priests that was speaking to us and preparing us for what it's going to be like to stand in front of the altar, he goes, don't think for a second that just because you're standing at the altar, that means you're going to be devoid of temptation. Even at the altar, you're going to be tempted. And then he gave us this example of a priest who used to come to him in confession and tell him about how it is that the demons would torment him at the altar by trying to remind him of very sinful situations that he was in, things that he has seen, experiences that he has had, even at the altar. The mind is capable of reminding us of things that, like, have you guys ever walked into a room and smelled something and it took you back years? Just the smell of something is capable of reminding you of your grandmother's house, your favorite restaurant, your favorite meal, or even church. This galabeya that I wear every single day, right? There are people that I'll go visit that haven't been into church forever, and when they come and greet me and they hug me, it's really awkward because some of them don't let go because I smell like church. It just reminds them of, obviously I don't smell it anymore because, like, I smell like it. I'm the embodiment of that smell, right? So I don't smell it on myself. But for other people, I'll walk by them and they're like, what is that? It's incredible how it is that the mind is capable of registering all of those things through the senses. What we've read, what we've seen, the conversations that we've had, the things that we have done with our hands, those places that we have allowed ourselves to go to, those experiences that we've shared with people, the mind registers all of these things and it tries to force back those memories into the heart. And when it enters back into the heart, the passion of lust begins to take action within us. And if it takes hold of us, it will eventually lead to us taking action. So what ends up happening? When a person is battling with the passion of fornication, eventually what they begin to realize is that they have created for themselves an idol. And it really is an idol, because ultimately what we are doing is worshiping at the altar of lust, of fornication. Why? We are told that God is our everything. God is our all in all. It is to God that we turn to for comfort. It is to God that we turn to for joy. When I am saddened and hurt, it is God who renews me. When I am broken and I am in need of some sort of comfort, it is God who can grant me that comfort. When I am brokenhearted and I am in need of joy, it is God who can grant me all of those things. God becomes my all in all. What ends up happening when I worship too often at the altar of lust? I turn to lust as if it was self-medication. I begin to literally prescribe to myself the pursuit of lust for the sake of being able to feel something different. When I want to numb my thoughts because I'm overly anxious, because I'm overly depressed, let me turn to something that will fill my mind. Chemically, it'll actually fill me with dopamine. It'll make me feel something different. It'll allow me to escape. And so what do? I go stand in front of the altar of lust and I say, let me please myself. Let me please myself through all of the different senses that I use. And some of us are pleased through a variety of different ways. There are those of us who turn to pornography, those who turn to masturbation, those who turn to very specific kinds of music or readings. There are people who love to watch these TV series that like never ending, like basically musalsalat, that are like filled with a whole bunch of dramatic and sexual connotations, and we just give in to that entirely. There are some of us who, what we will do is that we will turn to people who are very flirtatious because we enjoy conversations with those people and they make us feel a certain way. What the problem with this is that what we are training ourselves to do is that rather than turning to God, we literally turn to ourselves. It now has become what? Idol worship. Lust is intimately tied into pride, intimately tied into self-love. Why do you think that is? What do pride and lust have in common? Why do both of those passions fall hand in hand? Actually, the three of them that are considered brothers and sisters are pride, lust, and does anybody know what the third one is? Gluttony. Gluttony. Isn't that interesting? Pride, lust, and gluttony. Why those three? Any ideas?
The flesh.
Sorry?
The flesh.
What about the flesh? And what does the flesh have to do with pride? I can see the flesh in lust, and I can see the flesh in gluttony. But where is the flesh in pride? Sorry? What does that mean?
Like you're fulfilling
your own desire. The self is at the center, right? With pride, there's a self-centeredness where I'm only looking towards me. Gluttony is very similar, because gluttony is not about eating for energy, for growth, for sustenance. No, gluttony is all about eating because it pleases me. I want more because it tastes good. I'm going to have seconds because I can. So it's all about being a slave to what? To your taste buds and to the stomach. Now, lust is being a slave to the phantasmal desires. And when I say phantasmal here, I'm really talking about people who live in fantasy. There are these horror stories, Habibi. Horror stories of people who are so enamored by the demons of lust that the fantasies that they believe, the demons allow them to be able to dream them. And so in their dreams, they begin living out the very fantasies that they spend all day thinking about. Why do the demons allow that? Why do the demons whisper to them these very realities all the time, making them feel like they can touch it, they can taste it, they can have it? Why would the demons do that? It really is like giving heroin to an addict. Sorry?
I just said they become more enslaved.
Absolutely. The purpose is slavery. The purpose is absolute slavery. Because ultimately, what all addicts of lust have in common is that bittersweet feeling of saying, I want Jesus, but if I choose him, I have to give up my desires. I have to give up what pleases me. I have to give up what I turn to for comfort. If you speak to someone who has a porn addictions often come also with a very addictive habit of masturbation. Speak to someone who has a porn addiction, and they'll tell you, when I'm stressed and anxious, I turn to porn. Why? Because I want to escape my anxiety, right? I've had a very bad day and I'm feeling very angry and I just want to relax, I turn to porn. Because when I turn to porn, it's like somebody threw cold water on me. When I am happy and I want to celebrate something that went well and I want to offer myself something good as a reward, like a high five kind of thing, I turn to porn. I can take it, you're an addict. Happy, sad, mad, angry, everything is turned to what? Turned to porn. Now here's what's really interesting. You speak to a lot of people who have really given themselves over to the passion of lust, and they'll tell you things like, this is just a chapter in my life, I'm pretty sure I can stop whenever, and like, I have no intention of carrying this into my marriage. What are your thoughts? Giggle as much as you want, but what are your thoughts? Can I repeat? You just want to hear me say it again?
Can you do a smirk at the end too?
Huh? Yeah.
That's what I laughed at.
A person who is battling with an addiction to lust and is a slave to the passion of fornication, who says, this is only a chapter in my life. You know, this is, you know, a lot of, in Arabic, they always say it, khatit shabib. Khatit shabib, right? As if it was like only for a chapter, right? And so they say as if like, this is only during my youth. This is only while I'm single. Obviously, when I enter into a relationship and I'm married, there's no reason for this to continue. Like it'll stop by then. What would you tell that person? Let's speak practically on the subject. Go ahead.
Who's saying compared to Shalom?
Culturally, it's very commonly said in many Middle Eastern circles, right? So some people, for instance, it's interesting because in Arabic, like we're totally off topic now.
Sorry.
In Arabic, there are some people who won't say, you know, I struggle with masturbation. What they'll say is, "An nisbah afkhteit shabab." Okay? Or they'll say, it's funny because the actual word for masturbation, if translated word for word, is the habit that is done in secret. The habit that is done in secret. I don't know if there's an actual medical term for it in Arabic, but the only thing they call it is that habit that is done in secret.
It's the same in Arabic.
It's the same in Arabic.
Hey, hadisare is the actual medical term.
No, that's
not a cultural one. That's a cultural one. Hey, I'm translating Ada Sagaya.
Yeah.
It's the habit that is done in secret, right? Because people won't talk about it. People won't talk about it. So what do you tell a person who is now struggling with pornography, with masturbation, with the different expressions of the demons of fornication? What do you tell that person who thinks that just because you're getting married, everything is going to stop? Yes?
I'm very confused. Is it like sexual when he was talking about the marriage for the youth? It's like if they cannot like hold themselves, then they can marry and they're not like, I would prefer they not, like something like that.
Yeah, he does say it is better to marry than to burn.
But he was talking to the youth, right? Like not for old people.
Oh, no, he was definitely talking to the entire people of Corinth. He was talking to all of them. He wasn't just speaking to youth. The address that he was giving, the audience was everybody in Corinth. But when you have to understand that when St. Paul was writing that, he actually believed that Jesus was coming in his lifetime. So he was telling people, don't get married. Yani, why are you getting married? He's coming right around the corner. So when he would talk about, don't take for yourself a virgin, be rather like me, What he was really trying to tell them is just dedicate yourself to Christ. He's going to be here in a few years. And then later on, you see in the book of Ephesians, by the time he's actually speaking to wives and husbands and children, he came to the realization that when Jesus said, I'm coming soon, he didn't actually mean, yani, بعد بكرة. That he's going to come, but it won't be necessarily in his lifetime. And so you even see Saint Paul change his language. But when he did say it is better to marry than to burn, he's talking about those who could not choose for themselves a life of celibacy. If you could not choose for your life a life of celibacy, and you were tempted to take for yourself a woman, and to take her by force, literally he was talking to a people where culturally it was very acceptable that if you have a virgin, a servant, a slave who was living in your house, and you couldn't control yourself, and you would rape her, and culturally this was accepted. Culturally this was accepted because your slave was your property. And so when St. Paul was seeing this, he says, no, it is better for you to marry than to burn. So he was talking about extreme expressions of fornication, even to the point where it would be considered rape at times. But now, in our reality, yes, of course, if you can choose a life of celibacy and you're not being called to monasticism, then yes, no problem, pursue. And we know that in marriage, you fight. You fight, and in that arena of fighting with that person, in order for you to achieve together purity and repentance, you will fight against the passions. And your marriage will be one of the means by which you overcome sin. No problem. But my question to you is, what do you tell a person who has normalized the idea of, I'm just going to do this for a period of time until I get married, because as soon as I get married, I'm allowed to have sex anyways. And once I'm allowed to have sex, who needs porn? This is a very common thought. What do you tell those people? Sorry?
They have the wrong idea about marriage.
What is the wrong idea that they have?
They think it's going to fulfill the same fantasy that they can fulfill for marriage. So it's pretty cool. So it's going to be fun.
Yes?
I think there's two points here. Like the first point, that it's always not enough for this kind of person, but it's turned to an addiction. So it's always not enough. So you need more and more and more. The second point for me is that we always forget that there's another person on the other side. So it's not only always about me anymore.
So what did we say lust does? Lust, there is no other person to consider. All you're staring at is an object to be used. Right? So the only mood that you have to consider is your own. Right? When you're satisfied, you're satisfied. You shut it off and you walk away. Now you find yourself in a committed relationship where you are expected to give, not to forcefully take. And I promise you, I see this all too often. All too often in the beginning of marriages where people have not struggled and fought against the passion of lust up until the day of their marriage. And then they are shocked to see that I have to consider another human being. Then now I am not expected to just take. I'm expected to give, to offer, to be sacrificial in my approach. And that this becomes an expression of love, not an expression of lust. And then they are shocked to see that the fantasies that they had were completely irrational and delusional. And you can't replicate what you saw on the screen in the own intimacy of your own bedroom. And definitely, you're not going to sit there and tell the person across from you, can you do this? You're not going to do that. And then you begin to realize that the other person also has a sexual appetite. And you've trained yourself, because of your addiction, to have what you want, when you want, as often as you want. Not to mention that you can cater your fantasy. Right? There's categories now of sin. What do you like? What does your fantasy look like? Do you want the person to look like this? Like that? How old? What color of hair? What body size? Tall, short, small, fat, skinny? What do you want? Customize as you wish. Right? You think you're going to press buttons when you get married and things are going to adapt to whatever you want? And I'm sorry for being so scandalous in the way that I'm speaking, but it really is irrational for us to think that you can cater your fantasies and get used to having an appetite where you take what you want, whenever you want, as often as you want, and then suddenly walk into marriage and think, now I will be human. Before I was an animal. Habib Albi, that's not how it works. So what ends up happening? 6 months, 8 months, maximum a year later, married men and women are hiding from each other in their own homes, looking at these demonic devices and sinning in their own homes. In their own homes. Committing adultery against each other, staring at the nakedness of other bodies. Why? Because they thought that suddenly, because I'm actually having the expression of holiness in that sexual intimacy with my wife or my husband, that that's going to quench the desire. It meant that you got used to heroin. And you think a cup of shaybe leban is going to have the same effect as the heroin. You were never meant to experience that sinful expression. You were never meant to set on fire within you that kind of desire. This is going to satisfy something very different. You've created a beast and a monster, and now you want to put it on a diet? But that's not how this works. So a big part of what I want to encourage all of us to do is, as a younger generation of people who, some of us might be married, some of us might be in committed relationships but not yet married, some of us might still be praying and asking God, Lord, prepare me for marriage. But a big part of this is us being honest with ourselves and to say, Lord, help me to stand against the demons of fornication. Help me to not allow them to have a grip on my life. And the things that I see, the things that I hear, the things that I read, those conversations I have, the jokes I like to say, those movies I like to watch, those series that, it's incredible. I have to tell you, like, I grew up in the 80s and the 90s, and I have to tell you, like, we grew up where TV that had, like, a single bad word, like, you know the I can't say the word, of course I can't say the word. a female dog, okay? A female dog, okay? The B word. That word was not said on cable TV. And if you were to say it, it can only come on the screen past 9 p.m. where kids are supposed to be in bed. Today you open HBO and it's soft porn. It's soft porn. It has nothing to do with, like, right before I became a priest, Game of Thrones was really, really big, right? So people at work, did you watch Game of Thrones? Did you watch Game of Thrones? So I watched a couple of episodes and I'm like, what the hell? This has nothing to do with, like, actual war and fighting for, like, why? What's going on? Why? Like, what happened? Right? Everything is just like, whenever you can, yeah, throw in nakedness. Throw in promiscuity and prostitution and sex. Just throw it in. Why? There's viewership. There's viewership. And then people make compilations of this. Right? Every single sex scene in Game of Thrones here, 28 minutes of it. What are we doing? This is the society that we grew up in. It becomes so crazy when everything is so hyper and overly sexualized, and we're expected to not let this have an effect on us. The solution to fornication, the solution to fighting this demon of lust, is to first identify, are you falling prey to her cousins? Are you falling prey to the other sister passions? Are you struggling with pride and are you struggling with gluttony? Because let me be clear, if you think of yourself highly and you are a person who is struggling with pride, and if you're a person who's already giving in to the desires of the flesh at the level of your stomach, good luck trying to control your libido, trying to control your sexual desire. Until you've already told the flesh, اللي انت عايزه حبيبي هديهولك. هتيجي دلوقتي هديه هتقول له لا. But that's not how it works. There has to be a struggle at every level. Secondly, there has to be a pursuit of purity and life of repentance. There has to be. Because there's no hope for us to be able to not bring that toxicity into our relationships if we aren't fighting. And let me be clear. Sometimes many of us are scandalized to find out that the good people that we know and that we love are struggling with this. The problem is not whether or not a person has struggled with this. The real problem is there a real and sincere struggle. If you're in a relationship with a person who is struggling and who is fighting and they sometimes fail, that is a good thing. You have found a person who's fighting. And I would much rather a person who is fighting than a person who has surrendered to it and is trying to convince you that it's normal. So be the person who fights, regardless of whether or not you fail. But just be the person who fights and who says, I'm trying. I don't want this. I recognize how toxic it is. I recognize how it distorts the image and likeness of God that I'm supposed to see in my brothers and sisters. I recognize how it makes me look at people as if they were objects to be used only for my selfish desires. I recognize how it makes me just want to worship at the altar of my ego. I recognize all that it does, and I reject it and I fight against it. Do I still have, unfortunately, the habit of letting the thought descend into the heart, which ultimately leads to action? Yes, I still fail, but I'm fighting. Let's be that generation who fights. And then God, in His perfect timing, and after seeing you struggle for a time, will grant us victory. Will grant us victory so we don't bring that into our relationships. May God always grant us the peace of knowing that He will stand with us and give us that victory if we pursue it. To Him be glory now and forever, and to the ages of all ages. Amen. Any questions or comments about anything we discussed, Habibi?
I have a question, but it's... I don't know if it's off topic or not. I'll preface by saying I understand sexuality is something that's given by God, and it's good. And I also understand the statement that I'm going to make is not true, and there's many paths to a relationship with Christ. But why does it always seem like those who are celibate, or the like most of the people we see as saints, a lot of them are those who have chosen to deny their sexuality mm-hmm. for the sake of Christ. Why does it seem as though, and I guess maybe this is just from my perspective, that those who give it up have like a more intimate relationship with Christ than those who still pursue it in a holy manner within marriage? And I understand this is probably a misperception, but I'm just curious.
It's not a misperception. If we're being totally honest, there is a higher calling of celibacy to those who are willing to consecrate themselves entirely to God. But we have to be careful because language is sometimes defeating. Like, it's unfortunate that our language makes it sound like when I say there is a higher calling, that that somehow means that God prefers one over the other. It's not a matter of God looking more highly at you. What it is it is a more difficult journey. The same way that if we're being honest, right, two monks can live under the same monastery, one is a hermit, and one lives in a cell communally with his brothers. There is a more difficult path. The one who lives in the cave by himself, a hermit several miles away from everyone else and doesn't see the face of another human being for months on end, that is a more consecrated life. But that's not to say that somehow that means that person is more holy, more preferred by God. It is just a more difficult journey, and thus it is a greater offering. There is nothing wrong with that. And so for me to recognize that celibacy is a higher calling in that sense, where I say, Lord, I don't want anybody but you. You know what the difference is between a married person and a monk? The monk has said, Lord, I choose to love not a single person in the world. I only love you. A married person says, Lord, I choose to only love one person in the world, but you above all. It's not that somehow one is looked at by God, and somehow God looks at them and says, yeah, you did it right. Whatever, like, I'll still love Kareem because he got married, but like, I wish he was more like Baba Krollos. No. Like, no.
Does one have a greater intimacy? Like, in your opinion?
One has less distraction.
Okay.
And you have to understand that. In marriage, responsibility equals distraction. And God holds you accountable to that responsibility. Again, please don't harp on my words. Forget the fact that you don't like the word distraction. Get rid of your feeling for just a second and understand what's being said. When you are married, God says, if you love me, take care of her too. You must love her. You must support him and love him and respect him. You must take care of your children. God says, by loving me, you must also love them. And so they become a means by which you express love to God. Whereas in the celibate life, a consecrated life, there is nobody in the picture. It is just me and him. Which also, by the way, if we're being honest, opens up a great deal of additional levels of warfare. Because now you're open. You're not supported by those who love you. You really are just you and God. And so you're easy target practice for the demons, right? So to answer your question, why is it that when we look at the plethora of all the saints, so many of them were celibate? They chose a very high calling. But let me also remind you of this. When Saint Anthony spoke to God and told him, Lord, show me the one who is greater than me, right? He took him to Egypt, to Alexandria, where he saw a physician who was married, who every day would take what he needed to support his family, and then he would offer praises with the angels. This is Saint Anthony the Great. Saint Macarius, another example, tells God, show me, Lord. And he shows him two women who are married and who have children, who live together as sisters and support each other in dealing with their children and raising their families together. These are examples that God has shown the ascetics, the celibates, as look at these people who have chosen me and who have loved me, even while having the distraction and responsibilities of the world. Have you guys ever heard of Umm al-Ghalaba? Right? Her story is on. They made a video, a movie for her on YouTube. If you go take a look at it, here's this woman who's married and who has children, who has come closer to God than many of our saints, who has found a way to be able to utilize her relationships as a means by which she can trampoline herself up to God. Now, just to be clear, she has done something that is greater than most. Because that is not usually what happens when we get married and we have responsibilities of mortgages and homes and cars and schooling and savings and retirement plans, and those things oftentimes do serve as distractions that get in the way. And they're a normal part of everyday life of what it means to be married and have children, right? But to the consecrated celibate, those things aren't in the picture. But what is in the picture? Vainglory, self-love, the reminder of sins that are past, the hope for ordination and elevation. Like, those are very scary things that a lot of the consecrated men and women who live in monasteries and convents go through. I'm neither succeeding in this, and there's no way I would have survived in that. So I'm just focusing on repentance.
But we almost seen Anthony eventually, you know.
Oh,
say,
no, no.
He ends up where
Saint,
he, in yo, heaven. He's where God is.
Say, exactly. Saint, but it's funny. It's funny. It's funny that you say that. But I'm not sure. Anthony. Does everybody know what he's referencing?
No.
At some point, one of the monastics was shown a choir of the angelics with all the saints among them. And he saw all of them, and the angel was telling him, this is Pachomios, and this is Arsenius, and this is Moses the Strong, and this is that, and that's the Apostle Paul, and that's... And so he says, where is Anthony? And the angel replied and said, where God is, that's where Anthony is. Okay? Another story talks about how there's a reason why we call him Pinishti. There's a reason why he's called the Great. Another story of St. Anthony is one of the great monastic leaders, on his deathbed, God allowed him to be able to see the choir of the kingdom that was coming forward to be able to receive him. And he saw all of them filled with light. But there was one of them where the light was blinding. And the angel told him, that's Anthony. He shines the brightest in the kingdom. There is something beautiful about Saint Anthony. But just to be clear, Saint Anthony became Saint Anthony through the process of humility by showing him those two women, right? Where he desired in his heart and said that I must do more. If they outshine me, then I must give more, right? He pushed himself to that level, right? Just be careful not to think that every monastic who enters into and follows the steps of Anthony becomes Anthony.
Yeah. But Saint Anthony, But Saint Anthony is weird because, you know, they said he always strived to be the best in each virtue.
Yep.
So it's so weird. How did he manage to do that while staying humble? It's such. I feel like if I'm striving for a virtue, I get filled with pride so easily.
Yeah,
so
absolutely.
I don't know how he did it.
Saint Anthony must have at some point also struggled with extreme levels of pride, because when God opened his eyes and he saw in the front of him all the traps that were set up by the devil, St. Anthony himself says, who and how can anyone overcome? And the response that he heard was humility. And so he pursued it, right? Yeah. Don't forget that he had 85 years to perfect himself. 85 years in the desert. What's that?
I said, here's the hoping.
Here's the hoping.
I need all 85, I think.
Anything else?
Yeah, I do have a question. In the beginning, when you were starting the conversation, you said something about marriage being, I can't remember the exact words, but something about it being like a remedy or a help that God provided.
Yeah.
What did you mean by that?
So there's three major reasons that the church says that marriage is holy. Number one is that it is through marriage that God grants the gift of life through the offering of love to one another through procreation. Then there is the fact that marriage is a symbol of the love of God to His church. And then finally, that marriage really is a remedy to the passion of lust. That it is within marriage that we are capable, and I really wish people understood this, that people can walk up to each other and say, I am fighting within me the desires and the sins of my past. And that a husband and wife would be able to come together and say, then let's consume our love to fight that desire within you. Some people see that as perverted. Some people see that as like some form of like, if I tell that to my wife, she'll look at me and say, you're a pig. Right? But there has to be this realization that in consuming our offering of love to one another, in that communion that exists, I really do put out the flames that are trying to be set aflame within me. It is within that arena that St. Paul is capable of saying, it is better to marry than to burn. It is better to be able to perform and to have that act properly done in holiness and blessedness before God, rather than trying to satisfy it through sinful means. So it's in that sense that marriage becomes one of the solutions to fighting the sins and the passions.
This talk was brought to you by Upper Room Media. We hope that this talk has, through the grace of God, touched your heart. And we pray that it will not only inform you, but will also transform you and your life with Christ.